This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Each resident has been told to use only 87 liters. That's just under 23 gallons per day.
That's Nadia Same reporting from Cape Town. Details coming up. Also, polling stations have officially closed and vote counting is underway in Somaliland for the third presidential election since 2003. And Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says it has completed its investigation into 13 deaths linked to the country's election protests. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Somaliland's National Electoral Commission says polling stations have officially closed and vote counting is underway. The commission says voting went peacefully throughout the six regions today. The final election results is not expected for days. Officials say polling stations will send their tallies to regional offices, who will then pass the numbers on to the NEC. An international team of 60 election monitors are in Somaliland to oversee the election. The observers from 27 countries come from Europe, Africa, Asia, the U.S. and Canada. Turnout is expected to be high. More than 700,000 people have registered to vote and all have collected their biometric voter cards. Observers have hailed the biometric iris scanning process being used for this election because it doesn't allow multiple registration. Three candidates are vying to become the fifth president of Somaliland, which seceded from Somalia in 1991, but so far has not gained international recognition. Voters are choosing between Musi Biha, a former rebel commander, and a former minister of interior. Abdurrahman Muhammad Abdullahi Iro is the former speaker of Somalia and parliament, and Faisal Ali Waribi, a veteran opposition politician. Egyptian and international rights groups have filed a criminal complaint with Paris prosecutors over the sale of French surveillance technology to Egypt. The complaint alleges the Egyptian government uses the equipment to suppress opposition groups and human rights activists. Rights groups say the Egyptian government has become increasingly harsh towards any opposition. The United States has cut some of its aid to Cairo because of concerns over the human rights situation. Bahi El-Din Hassan is the founder and general director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies. He currently lives in exile because he says he was threatened by the Egyptian government. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the basis for the criminal complaint.
The complaint was filed jointly with the International Federation for Human Rights and the French League for Human Rights. And it is based on an investigative report made by a French magazine called Télérama about using such technology. Firstly, with Libya under Gaddafi, which also it is another case before the French court, with the same company, was also reported earlier by Wall Street Journal. The company didn't challenge the facts which published by those two newspapers.
But isn't it the right of any country to use surveillance technology to protect its national security?
Yes, it is. But in some cases, like what was proved in the case of Libya, Muammar al-Qaddafi, it was proved and documented that such technology was used mainly against the peaceful opposition, against peaceful dissidents, against human rights defenders, against journalists, because on the air already in the Egyptian media, which is now under full control of the Sisi government, there are a lot of phone calls, the personal pictures and the reports about some personal meetings. It is already leaked to those media, which once again question the possibility of using such technology on spying against peaceful Egyptians. The Sisi government consider human rights organization reports and documentation of violations as a threat to the national security.
So what kind of ruling you expect the French judicial could produce in this case?
We expect first that public prosecutor would accept the complaint and open a formal investigation in this case. As you may guess, that the Sisi government would not cooperate at all, not only with Egyptian human rights organization like Cairo Institute, but also with any serious investigation from external parties. So we hope that through cooperation from the side of the French company, according to the French law, the prosecutor and then the court can find out proofs on our complaint.
That was Bahi Eldin Hassan, founder and general director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawy from Paris. A Saudi-led coalition says it will reopen some airports and seaports in Yemen to allow humanitarian aid. The move comes a week after the coalition temporarily closed all ports in response to the firing of a missile from Yemen towards Riyadh. The coalition blamed the vulnerability in inspection procedures for allowing Iranian military equipment to reach Houthi rebels. A coalition statement said the first ports to reopen would be those under control of the Yemeni government, including Aden, Mukalla, and Mocha. It further called for the United Nations to send inspectors to rebel-controlled ports such as Hadida to boost inspection and verification steps to prevent smuggling of weapons from Iran. Iranian officials have repeatedly denied arming the Houthis, who seized the Yemeni capital Sana'a in late 2014. Last week, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif pointed to Saudi Arabia's role in the conflict since it began airstrikes supporting Yemen's government in March 2015. The fighting in Yemen has left at least 10,000 people dead and millions in need of humanitarian aid. Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says it has completed its investigation into 13 deaths linked to the country's election protests. VOA reporter Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi says the authorities recommended that some officers face prosecution. The case includes the death of a little girl who was struck by a bullet while she was on her family's balcony, and the death of a baby who was hit by a police baton when officers raided her parents' home looking for protesters. Political protests began in August ahead of Kenya's presidential election and continued through last month's court-ordered election rerun. Human rights groups say more than 60 died in the crackdown on protesters, but police officials say the number is 19. Yusuf reports that more investigations are expected in the coming weeks, but he says Kenyans aren't confident that any police officers responsible for deaths will be brought to trial. He says that's because there have been many cases filed, but only one last year has resulted in officers being convicted and jailed. Music. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Polling stations have opened in Somaliland for the third presidential election since 2003. And Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says it has completed its investigation into 13 deaths linked to the country's election protests. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The city of Cape Town is the tourism jewel of South Africa. Every end-of-year holiday season, it bustles with tourists keen to find a spot on the beautiful beaches and in the majestic mountains. But all is not well this season. In the face of a crippling drought, residents are forced to be very creative with the meager amount of water each person is allowed to use daily. With the dams running critically low, the onslaught of tourists spells a bigger drain on an already dwindling resources. From Cape Town, Nadia Same reports.
The drought in South Africa's Western Cape province is entering its third year. 2017 was particularly bad because Cape Town's brief rainy season yielded very little rainfall. It led to ever-increasing water restrictions for locals and stiff monetary sanctions for those who ignore it. Councillor Xanthia Limburg is the city's mayoral committee member for water waste.
The city of Cape Town and the Western Cape is experiencing a severe drought, and the dam levels are currently at about 37%. This is particularly low given that we have now exited the rainfall period, which is normally our winter period, and we are going into our summer period with very low levels of water within our dams.
The challenge has paved the way for creativity. A locally produced mobile app allows residents to monitor their usage by entering, for example, the duration of their shower and how much water they use to wash vegetables. Each resident has been told to use only 87 liters. That's just under 23 gallons per day. That includes showering, cooking, and doing the laundry. It's forced residents to think out of the box.
We catch our shower water with buckets. My husband and myself, we conserve our water. Obviously, a shower doesn't consist of a full-length shower. It's very much on and off. So we'll wait and prep and then switch it off. And then we'll lather and then we rinse, basically. And so the amount of water from the shower is not that much, but it is the water we use for our toilet.
While brushing my teeth, I switch the water off and put it on again and use as little as possible.
I have a massive swimming pool. There's a lot of evaporation that takes place. And I used to top up my pool on a monthly basis. What I've since done is I've bought special connectors and plumbing piping, and I've connected it to my gutters. So when it rains, all the water that falls on the surface of the roof goes into the gutter, and I've directed it that it goes within my swimming pool. Basically, it means I don't have to top up again.
Large parts of South Africa are key tourist destinations, and Cape Town tops that list. While the visitors spell extra dollars for the local economy, it's also a strain on the ailing water supply. Water authorities and city officials like Xanthia Limburg say they're prepared to accommodate the influx.
The city has launched a special campaign just for the tourist season called Save Like a Local to ensure that every tourist that visits our city also sticks to the 87 liters of water per person per day, just like the everyday Cape Townians are doing to ensure we contribute to overall water savings.
The city's also met with the main union representing the hospitality industry to urge all hotels, guest houses and restaurants to use water wisely. As visitor numbers pick up, many locals are expressing concern about the possible drain on their water reserves. They know once the holidays end and the bustle has died down, there's a possibility they may face even stricter water restrictions. For VOA Africa, I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
UNESCO's Global Education Monitoring Report shows some of the challenges sub-Saharan countries face in providing quality educations for all children, one of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. UNESCO figures show that Africa lags behind other parts of the world in educating young people. For example, 41% of children do not finish primary school, and 87% of those enrolled do not reach the minimum proficiency level in reading. The latest report looks at some of the reasons for the failures, including school management, corruption, and the quality of teachers. Manos Antoninis is the director of the report and spoke with VOA's William Eagle about the problems with Africa's schools.
The main reason is, first of all, that the education systems in sub-Saharan Africa expanded rapidly after 2000, with the result that it was very difficult for national education systems and teacher education systems to catch up. But in addition to that, there were also financial constraints, not just capacity constraints, and governments tried to make up for that by increasingly, in some cases, hiring contract teachers. And these contract teachers had not received the expected officially mandated training, but only very short-term training.
Are not contract teachers trained on the same level as conventional teachers?
The big problem in many sub-Saharan African countries was precisely that there was a rapid need for the supply of teachers to expand. And the decision was taken that there was no time to wait for teachers to go through 2 or 3 years of education before they could be hired. Another idea was that attracting trained teachers to rural areas might have been very complicated. Perhaps attracting teachers who were prepared to be paid less would have fewer qualifications, but would be actually coming from some of the more remote areas, would be a more promising strategy to fill the teacher gap quickly.
Many people cite the failure of teachers to show up at school, but the Global Education Monitoring Report says that issue is actually more complicated than that. I wonder if you could touch on that issue. I think that, for example, some governments are said not to officially allocate all of the school days available, or that there are other reasons for teacher absence beyond the teacher's control.
Indeed, the report urges caution because often many other reasons that are related to the system are really responsible for the fact that absenteeism levels seem to be high. Or there are issues related to training. Teachers are often sent to training that the system is not prepared to accommodate for.
Manos, to what degree does corruption affect the quality of teaching in Africa? For example, we hear about so-called ghost roles or the failure of the state to deliver promised resources.
The absenteeism of teachers who are considered ghost teachers. We quote an example from Nigeria where 8,000 teachers in 4 states were reported collecting their official salary. And sometimes it's even difficult to understand how many teachers are ghosts because they may be appointed not to schools but to local governments and still receiving salaries without teaching. We also have other more subtle phenomena of corruption. When teachers are being paid very poorly, there is in some countries a phenomenon of private supplementary tuition where teachers may not be teaching the full curriculum in the class, but may be inviting students, those who can afford, to join them after school in additional classes where they deliver the full curriculum. Teachers then receive additional tuition fees from the students in order to be taught the full curriculum and get trained for example, to pass an exam.
The report says that public and civic activism has forced many governments to improve education. Can you give examples of where citizen activism has made a difference?
All countries, in some way or another, have ratified some international treaty that calls upon them to respect and fulfill the rights to education. But in only 55% of countries, can citizens legally challenge and take the government to court when they violate the rights to education? And in fact, only in 41% of countries have citizens exercised this possibility, and that has often led to very effective interventions and changes on the government side. The legal route is not the only solution. Civil society has other routes. You expect, for example, the parliament to be able to challenge government, like an education committee, for example, of a parliament, to be able to ask the right questions when the budget is submitted. So civil society has, in some cases, played the role of helping provide capacity to parliamentarians to build their skills in order to ask the questions and send back the budget to the government. That's an example which has happened in Tanzania. Another example is when actually citizens take the case to the streets. In South Africa, there has been a an example of one publicized case of university tertiary education fees that were very high and increasing at rapid rates that were excluding the poorer students. The Fees Must Fall movement was then generated and was fueled with effective use of social media, which helped organize students, took them to the street, and as a result, the government was obliged to freeze fees and to institute a commission that is expected to deliver its verdict on what should be the future funding policy and fee-paying policy in the country to enable tertiary education to be affordable.
That was Manos Antoninis, the director of UNESCO's Global Monitoring Report. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. In Malawi, the government has lifted the ban on maize exports. It was imposed 3 years ago amid food shortages caused by floods and then drought. President Peter Mutharika says he has changed the policy because the country now has enough maize stock. However, farmers say the change has come too late to help them. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Mutharika imposed the ban to prevent a repeat of the shortage Malawi faced 15 years ago. Statistics from the Ministry of Agriculture show that this year Malawi has produced a surplus of more than 30% over last year. Good rains during the last growing seasons are credited for the bumper harvest. Rafiki Hajati is the executive director for the Blantyre-based think tank, the Institute for Policy Interaction. He says the government is wrong to lift the ban.
You've got global warming, you've got the change of climate, rains are uncertain, erratic, heat is increasing. So it is essential to ensure that you have more than adequate food stocks in place in case disaster strikes.
He says the government has failed to learn from its mistake years ago when it exported all the surplus maize, only to import some of the same crops a year later. But Mutharika says that this year the country has enough.
I'm convinced that there's no danger now. My concern was orange, but I was not going to allow the export of maize until I was sure that there will be enough maize in this country. I'm now convinced but that technically has been reached.
During this year's harvest season, farmers protested the maize export ban, saying it deprived them income they would earn from selling their surplus maize outside the country. The Farmers Union of Malawi said in a statement that maize prices in the eastern region of Africa range from $300 to $700 per metric ton. That was almost triple what local buyers offered. But the government reinforced the ban by deploying military along the country's borders. Alfred Kapichila Banda is the president of the union.
It's now too late for farmers. They are not going to benefit anything because all their maize has been taken away at a very low price, 50 kwacha per kilogram.
Banda says those who will benefit will be traders who bought the maize from farmers at low prices. Economist Ben Galua says most of the countries that imported the commodity from Malawi have now stopped buying it since the lifting of the export ban has come too late. Galua says this will likely result in price hikes of maize at the local markets should some traders decide to hold the grain to sell it at higher prices in future. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Wokinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello. Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.